If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Welcome, everyone. It's Karen Conti. Last time in the Showcase Studio here, looking out over Michigan Avenue, although we can't really see much because it's pretty foggy out there. I can barely see you guys out here. Hi. So we have a great show. It's kind of action-packed. We're going to be talking about suicide with Dr. Shulman from Rush Hospital. Obviously, the two high-profile suicides that happened this week has caused a lot of people to ask questions. Why would you commit suicide when you have everything in life that everyone else wants? You have fame, you have money, you have a good life, and you still want to take it. And we're going to be talking a little bit about that, what the warning signs are, and what happens to the survivors. What kind of grief do they have after a suicide like this? And then we're going to be talking to authors of a great book that I read called Breaking Through Bias, and it's about how women are in the workplace and are getting treated a little bit differently. They're perceived differently, and they need to really change their communication skills in order to get what they want. And I'm telling you, as a lawyer for 31 years, this book really, really resonated with me, and I wish that I had read it that long ago. And then we're going to be talking to the president of the Illinois State Bar about a number of issues in Illinois and about the Brock case where the judge was recalled after rendering a sentence that a lot of people thought was too short for a rape of by a Stanford swimming person. Anyway, we're going to be talking about that and a million other things, and then we're going to be taking your calls. Your calls, usually we take about 8, but we're going to start them probably around 8:30 tonight. So make sure you get your calls ready. Any legal question you might have, it's fair game. I'll try to answer it, try to direct you to the right person or direct you to the right agency. And our number, 312-981-7200, or text to that number, 981-7200. I want to talk just briefly before we have our first guest on. And Roger, maybe you want to engage with me on this one. But sure. I read about this high school student from California, I believe, and she was giving her speech, and her microphone was cut short by the administration because she wanted to talk about sexual assault. Are you aware of that story, Roger?
I have not heard that one, but I have heard other instances, a couple of other ones from across the country, where similar things were done to the salutatorian, valedictorian, whoever was giving the main speech, that, in fact, one who was not allowed to give their speech, but then went out into the park with a bullhorn and gave their speech.
Well, it raises some interesting questions because as a lawyer, I get asked the question, why can't, if you're at a public school, and public schools would be, the First Amendment would apply because it's the public school, it's not a private school, that there are different rules for that. Mm-hmm. Can the school curtail or curb or cut off a student's First Amendment right to free speech? And from what I have seen over the years, yes, they can. Schools are a little bit different than a workplace. Schools are a little bit different than a government telling people they can't talk, because a school has more obligation to children. And children who are minors, they need to be kept safe. They need to be kept orderly. And I think that a court would probably rule that in order to have children give speeches, that they have to run it past the administration to make sure that what they're going to say is not going to be offensive to people and the like. Although, I don't know. The court could go another way on that one, and it's going to be interesting to see if there are any lawsuits that stem from that. I know, Roger, you're right. There were several other cases, one where I think one of the students wanted to talk about the Parkland shooting, mm-hmm. and the administration said no, and one of valedictorian wanted to stand up and name all the undocumented immigrants in the class, mm-hmm. just to make a point about immigration. But again, I see this in the cases where you have school newspapers.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you've seen that a lot, where someone wants to publish an article, and whether it's got a sexual connotation or racial connotation, the schools will ban it, and then there are lawsuits that ensue. And generally speaking, the schools win those cases.
Yeah, and I was the faculty supervisor at two high schools, for the school newspaper, and I kind of played a gatekeeper. I don't want to say that it was that I did it before the fact, but I would let the students know that I don't think that the principal is going to allow this, but we still then sent it to the principal for their approval or disapproval, and then it would come back one way or the other. I do know that my alma mater, Evanston Township High School, this past year had a major blow up with an issue about drugs, and had interviews and quotes from students who talked about how easy it was to get drugs in the school, and their life involved with drugs and stuff. And while it initially got published, it got pulled a little later that day by another administrator over the one who had allowed it to go. So there's been a lot of, and it's along the same lines, these speeches at graduation. You're still a student of the school.
Yeah.
It is still the school, and schools technically are a parent's extension.
Right.
So,
well, and I think, you know, like anything else, people think that your rights are absolute, and there are a lot of cases where things collide, and we're going to talk maybe a little bit about the cake baker case that came down in the U.S. Supreme Court. Yes, you have a right to freedom of speech, but you also have a right to be served without discrimination, and sometimes those rights collide, and someone has to make the decision as to which one prevails.
Exactly.
But we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Russell Hartigan, the president of the Illinois State Bar Association. This is Karen Conti on WGN. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. With us in studio is Russell Hartigan, the president of the Illinois State Bar Association. Russell's practiced law for over 43 years. He's handled numerous memorable cases. He served as a judge for about 6 years, and now, along with being president of the Bar Association, he's a mediator and an arbitrator. Welcome to the show.
Welcome, Karen. Good to see you.
We have known each other for 30 years, I think, give or take.
Absolutely.
I met you when I was 3, and so you can all do the math out there. Russ, you know, you're president of the Bar Association, which is a great honor, and obviously lawyers think a lot about you. But I want to talk briefly about the reputation of lawyers. And I see the billboards, and I see the ads, and I see all of these things, and I wonder, do you think that those kinds of ads and that kind of the advertising campaigns, are they good for our profession?
Well, it is getting out of hand a little bit. I agree. I mean, going years back, you couldn't do some of the things that you're seeing now. We're going to probably ask direction from the Illinois Supreme Court, who essentially regulates lawyers. One of our committees is the Future Committee. We're looking at the Avvo, we're looking at the LegalZoom, we're looking at all these companies that are coming forward that to help market lawyers. So, yeah, yes, there is solicitation, it seems, out there. And,
yeah.
There's a lot of marketing, and you move, you know, you pay more to move up
the ranks, yes.
The ranks, yes.
Well, and I tell people all the time, as I'm sure you do, how do I know what's a good lawyer? And it's not the person whose name is on the bench. It's not necessarily the person whose name comes up first, because those people might be clever marketers, but they may not be good lawyers. In fact, the good lawyers may not even be doing any of that stuff.
Absolutely. One thing you can do is go to the Attorney Registration and Discipline Committee. Just make sure that the lawyer is a lawyer.
That's true.
There's a recent book out about three law actually they weren't graduates, but they decided to leave law school, a Grisham novel, and they started practicing, and nobody challenged them. The judge didn't challenge them, the lawyers, you know, state's attorneys, public defenders. So that, number one. Number two, a lot of people, if they're really sole practitioners, small firms, they like to be rated on Avvo. And so that's the new thing. And the other thing is just to check with the bar associations. And, you know, word of mouth is still out there.
Exactly. That's what I say. Yeah. I mean, if you have a good accountant or a good business manager or your financial planner, those are the people to go to, because they get in that position to make referrals. And even if you ask a neighbor, and maybe you've got a neighbor who might know something, but again, their experience with one lawyer may not be the same in another practice area.
Yeah, the hedge fund people are buying into companies for marketing of attorneys, and it's becoming a big business. And we hope that in certain respects there's some brakes put on it, and ultimately the Supreme Court will take a look at that.
Yeah. Now, this case coming out of California was very interesting. There was a judge who gave a lenient sentence to a kid named Brock Turner who raped a girl. He was from Stanford. He was a swimmer. The woman made national news when she gave a speech to the court about what she went through and the trauma that she sustained. And as a result, there was an uproar. I think he gave a 6-month term sentence, but it was legal. It was within his realm to do that. It was certainly legal, and no one said that it wasn't. It was just that many people thought that he got off way too light, and this was not the only such case where he sentenced someone lightly for a sexual assault. Would we ever see anything like that in Illinois?
Well, we have judges coming up for what we call retention, and that's a question of should the judge be retained, yes or no. And generally speaking, most judges survive that retention issue. You'll be seeing on the ballot shortly, because the ISBA, Illinois State Bar, is going through judicial evaluations right now for retention judges.
So they make recommendations so that when you go to the ballot, you at least will have some semblance of, hey, are these people good or are these people not doing their job?
Right. I mean, on one hand, you have to respect the judge's independence, his discretion. On the other hand, if you're not comfortable with that ruling, you can always go to the ballot box and try to remove them.
That's right. And again, you know, I think I agree with you that, you know, we have to give the judiciary some leeway, because the public doesn't always know what the rules are, and the public doesn't always understand exactly what a judge might be doing and for the reasons. And so normally I would say this is not a good thing, because you don't want to make the judge a political figure that if you don't sentence someone or you don't convict somebody, you're going to lose your job. That's probably not a good idea. But I think in this case, from what I glean, that this judge really has taken these cases very lightly. And the public spoke. They organized. They raised over $1 million, and they recalled him. It was kind of an interesting phenomenon. And maybe it's a heads up for judges to know that they are accountable. So
I do recall back in the 70s or 80s, a judge who had a ruling, it was either favorable or unfavorable against a police officer, and he was not retained because of that ruling.
I do remember that. I do remember that exactly. And it was a racial case, and it was very, very, very much a heater case, and the judge got blamed for what happened. Yeah. So just before we take a break, Russ, I want to ask you a question. I mean, people are coming out of law school, kids are coming out of law school with huge amounts of debt, and the jobs are not as good as they used to be. What would you say to people who want to go to law school, or parents who have children who are aspiring to be lawyers? Is it still a good thing to be a lawyer?
You know, I'm a big cheerleader. I have a course called Law Practice Management at Kent Law School and John Marshall, and we tell them there's always new areas of the law that are opening up. At the ISBA, we have a new, what they call, Privacy Section Council. You couldn't believe how many lawyers wanted to get on that. That's a whole new area of the law. So I always tell them new things are opening up, and, you know, be optimistic. Even my son, who's a lawyer, he said, oh, there's too many lawyers out there. You know, we got too many law schools in Illinois. I said, well, you know, do the best you can. Get out there. Do what I did. My father wasn't a lawyer. You just got to, you know, work at it and see what particular field you're interested in and go into that.
There's always room for another good lawyer, right?
Absolutely. And certain areas of Illinois need lawyers. And I talk to other people in different states, and they say there are certain states that, like Idaho, they need lawyers.
Yeah. So it's a matter of wanting to go to Idaho, I suppose. Russell Hartigan, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on being the president of the Illinois State Bar. And have a good rest of your summer.
I have a face for radio. You don't.
Thank you. Thank you, Russ. I appreciate it. You're listening to Karen Conti on WGN. Well, on this day in 1963, John Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act to abolish gender-based wage disparity. And here we are in 2018. Women start their careers on equal footing with men. That's the common thought. But generally, women leave careers earlier. They don't achieve what men achieve, and they're paid less and are less satisfied in the workplace. We're going to be talking to authors who wrote a book about bias in the workplace. And if there's bias, what do we do to combat it? With us today are Andy Kramer and Al Harris, authors of the book Breaking Through Bias, Communication Techniques for Women to Succeed at Work. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you very much.
We're glad to be here.
So a friend of mine, Jody Silberman, who's listening, she's a listener for years, recommended that I read this book. I think she may have even sent this to me. And I read it, and I really, as I said before, it really resonated with me because I realize what you're saying in this book essentially is that women don't do things in a wrong way. It's just that we're perceived differently, and we have to know that when we go to work. So is that a fair summary of kind of where you're going with the book?
Absolutely. Women are fine the way we are, except that when we go to workplaces which are predominantly gender biased, what happens is there are expectations and assumptions about how women are supposed to behave, expected to behave, and punished if we don't behave. And those are the issues that we need to address and try to overcome to succeed in our careers.
We're going to be talking a lot about bias, so I think maybe we ought to get that word out right away.
Sure.
By bias, we're not talking about the old-fashioned, explicit, the phrase used to be male chauvinist pigs.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about implicit or unconscious stereotypes and attitudes that we all have. One way or another, we're all biased. We all harbor expectations of the way people, because they fall into particular groups, will behave, will be like. That's true of women. That's true of racial minorities. That's true of all sorts of people. So when we talk about bias, don't think we're pointing our finger at somebody and saying, you're a bad person. Biases surround us. And what we're trying to do in this book and in our work is to provide women with some help as to how they can deal with inherently biased situations.
And your book, to its credit, also talks about men and what men can do, because having women in the workplace and having women succeed in the workplace is a goal of a lot of people, not just women. I think men want women to succeed, but maybe there are some things that men do without meaning to do them in a malicious way that are preventing women from getting to where they need to be. So let's talk a little bit about what are the general biases that people have with women in the workplace. What are they looking for women to be, and how are they perceiving women differently?
Well, there are stereotypes about women, men, work, families that we have. By the time we're 3-4 years old, we've developed many of these stereotypes because of the environment that we're brought up in. And so the stereotypes and the biases that flow from them about women are that we're supposed to be kind and sweet and modest and caring and supportive and all sorts of helpful things.
Yes.
Right. And the word for that is communal, which comes from the word community. And that's what women are expected to be punished if we're not. The stereotypes about men are that men are agentic, and that comes from the word agency. And an agent is somebody who has a job to do, going to get something done. And so the stereotypes about men, about agentic people, is that they're willing to take a stand. They're independent. They're unemotional. They're gonna be leaders. And so when we go to the workplace, what happens is we have these stereotypes about women and these stereotypes about men, and the expectation is that who's going to be the leader? Well, the leader's going to be somebody who's going to take charge and get the job done. And so that cuts against the stereotypes and the expectations that we have for women.
And so there's a part in your book where you talk, and I love this because I think I've seen this reflected in toward myself. She's pushy, he's persuasive. She's bossy, well, he's a leader. She's a self-promoter and a braggart, he knows his own worth. She's abrasive, he's incisive. She's selfish, he's too busy to pitch in. I mean, I've seen that at the workplace where you are doing the same exact thing, and I get this, and you are both practicing lawyers at some points in your life, you're still a practicing lawyer, and you guys, you know what I'm talking about. I'm arguing before a judge, and I'm trying to be persuasive, and I'm being an advocate, and the judge says, relax, calm down. And the other lawyer, a male, is doing much more than I'm doing. And I am somehow being perceived as being emotional instead of being an advocate. I've had that happen to me on more than one occasion.
What we find is that many, many women are told you're too aggressive. That's a favorite phrase that the social scientists have found comes up over and over again in job evaluations and decisions. You're too aggressive. What are they doing? They're making their presence felt. They are asserting themselves in an appropriate manner. And yet when a woman is firm, decisive, thoughtfully opinionated, she's often viewed as aggressive, whereas a man can be far more in your face without triggering that kind of a response.
And the point about emotion, too, very often if a woman is committed to making a point, then she's told she's too emotional when a man is he's committed to his, to the point that he's making.
So is it ever okay to say to a male boss or a judge, maybe not a judge, but maybe
better be careful.
Yeah, better be careful. But to say, listen, very nicely, I'm doing the same thing that John is doing, and I'm sorry, but you're misperceiving who I am. I'm just getting this job done just like John. Is that something you do, or is there another tactic that will work to fight that sort of bias?
Well, I think, yes, it is appropriate to do that, but to not do it in front of John.
Yes.
That right. is, you don't want to do that kind of thing in public. But there's nothing wrong with taking a male boss aside or even going to a judge in another context and saying, I'm trying to make my points. I'm trying to get across this argument. Now, I'm not doing anything other than what a man would do.
Sometimes if you flag the fact that you acknowledge that your behavior might be perceived or is being perceived by the other person as being out of the stereotype that they expect, then that goes a long way to disarming them. And I think Al's point about doing it on the side is just that you want to be certain that you're not putting the other person in a position where they've got their back up.
I want to talk just briefly before we take a break about what benevolent sexism is, and I've been a victim of this as well. I'm going to tell you just a brief story. I was in my very first job, and it was a litigation position that was pretty, aggressive, and it revolved travel, and it revolved around long hours, and my boss said to me, you really don't want to be doing this kind of work. You might want to walk over to this section because you're going to want to have children and a family, and this is just not going to be good for you because, you're just not going to like it, and you're going to want your free time with your family. And so he was essentially telling me not to do this work that I wanted to do. Is that benevolent sexism?
Absolutely. The problem with benevolent bias and benevolent sexism is that very often the woman who it's being subjected to it can get sucked into thinking that they're actually doing her a favor. And so it might be, oh, you have a family, why don't you go home and I'll take care of this. You don't have to stay tonight to get the work done. But then when it comes time for compensation and evaluations and promotion, well, she just didn't contribute the same that the guy did. And so we found that a lot of the responses to our book have been people who said, I hadn't realized what it was about my boss that was making it hard for me to advance, and it was really this benevolent bias where they were pretending to be doing me a favor, maybe even thinking that they were doing me a favor, but in reality they were holding me back.
If you have any questions for our authors, give us a call here at 312-981-7200. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. About women in the workplace and gender bias and how women are perceived a little bit differently than men. And it's not men's fault. It's just the way it is. It's the way of the world, and women perceive men differently, I'm sure. So we're talking to Andy Kramer and Al Harris, who are the authors of Breaking Through Bias, Communication Techniques for Women to Succeed at Work. They're adjunct professors at Northwestern School of Law and attorneys. Welcome back. Let's talk nuts and bolts here. Let's talk about what a woman should do verbally in the workplace that would help them with these issues and these problems.
Well, one of the issues about language and patterns is that very often, because women were trained to not want to appear too aggressive in your face, very often we might use phrases like, this may be a dumb idea, but, or I wasn't here when the conversation started, so I might have missed something. Sort of these kinds of phrases that are meant to tone down the important thing that we're going to say. And those are things that women should avoid, because what that does is that makes women and men think that she really doesn't have anything to contribute. And so even if Einstein had said, I think this is a dumb idea, but E equals MC squared, no one would have been paying attention to what he had to say.
That's right. And you also talk in the book about apologizing and how women are big apologizers for things that aren't their fault or that they shouldn't be sorry for. And I've seen me do that. And it is probably just because we are trained as women to tone it down and to be the softer touch.
When women say, I'm sorry, and they say it all the time, or many women say it, it's to build a relationship. It is to connect with the other person. It's to show that they do care about them, that they are supportive, that they are empathetic. What the problem is when women say, I'm sorry, is that other people can mean, well, did she do something wrong?
Right.
Is she at fault? No, if you go into, you lose a big case and the woman on the team says, I'm so sorry. Well, the men look around and say, what did she do wrong that caused this loss?
Must have been her fault, not the guy's.
Obviously her fault.
Because they didn't apologize.
Correct.
Interesting. And, you know, I guess another issue here is body language and kind of nonverbal things, but the way people speak and the way people hold themselves. What are some good nuts and bolts for that?
Well, one thing that I would suggest is that women need to throw our shoulders back and sit up straight and not be scrunched over and get smaller. Men tend to gesture away from their bodies, and women tend to gesture towards our bodies. That makes the men look bigger and more powerful, and the women look smaller. Men, when you're talking to them, could be looking at the ceiling, and a woman's reaction is, he's not paying any attention to me, when in reality he's listening. But if a woman is angry, she's looking at the ceiling. If a man is angry, he's looking right at you. And so there's these body language things that can be misconstrued by the other person. But one thing that I would recommend is take up space. Women very often, when we're sitting at a table, if the table fills up, the women will move and squish and make room for the newcomer. The guys don't do that. They might even have two seats with their coat on a second seat. And so go into a meeting, take control, put down papers, put down books, put down your computer, even if you're not going to use it, to just show that you're entitled to and have a right to space.
And isn't this interesting that a man doesn't think twice about it? He just does it. And we, as women, have to think about it because that's just not in our nature. It adds a little layer of extra activity in our brains here.
Absolutely.
That's one of the pushbacks that we often get having addressed women, is that women will say, why do I have to do it? Why does the burden fall on me? I'm not the one that's exercising the bias. It's the system. It's the men I work with. It's my organization. They should change. I can be the way I am. And our response to that is, well, we can all wait around for the next millennium. But if we're going to get ahead now, there are things that women can do to take the situation into their own hands right now. And that's the tips we try to provide.
That makes total sense. I mean, this basic example I give my students when I'm talking to them is about how to dress to go to court, because I feel that I need to tell people that these days. And I'll say, if you walk into a store on Michigan Avenue with sweatpants on and a headband and, you know, no one waits on you, that's not right. They should treat everyone equally because I am on my day off and maybe I dress down on my day off. But if I come in all dressed up, I know what kind of treatment I get. It's a whole different thing. And again, you can either fight the system or you can understand it and do well by it. And I think that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. One of the toughest and most radioactive topics is about dressing and appearance. Women will very often be very offended by even the conversation. And so you're gutsy to talk about that in your class. But the reality is that people might need a little direction and might need to know. You're going to dress differently if you're going to a meeting in Silicon Valley than you would if you were going to a meeting on Wall Street. And so those are things that we need to keep in mind.
Quickly, I want to address the issue. You're writing a new book, and it's about women bosses, women in power, and how they're perceived. There's always this perception that women bosses are hard to deal with, hard to work for. Is that true, or is that, again, a problem of bias?
We think it's a problem of bias, but it is certainly a pervasive notion. The popular press is filled with it. The trade book press is filled with books all about mean girls or the stiletto in the back or the bitch I work with.
Yep.
Or whatever else it is, because women are very sensitive to their relationships with other women. Men are not nearly as sensitive to their relationships. And so women are concerned when they don't get along with women. Women are concerned when another woman is not kind or nurturing or helpful to them. And when that happens, they react negatively. And we think that that's primarily what's happening when women say they don't want to work for women.
And so men doing the same thing by being a leader.
He's
women do the same thing.
He's just being a leader.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'd like to, again, tell everybody that this is Andy Kramer and Al Harris, Breaking Through Bias. You can get it on Amazon or any bookstore. Where can they reach you if they need to talk to you?
If the best place to reach us is at our website, Andy, A-N-D-I-E, and Al, all one word, .com.
Thank you so much. Have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.
Goodbye.
You're listening to WGN. Welcome back. We're going to be taking your calls at about 8:30, a little bit late this week, but I will get in as many as I can. My number here is 312-981-7200. If you have any comments for me or any of the guests that I have on, please give us a call. We'd be happy to take them. This week we had celebrity suicides, two of them, and we're shaking our heads saying, what, you know, these people had it all. They had money, they had fame, they had accomplishment, they had enviable lives. Why did they do it? Joining us to discuss the tragedy of suicide is Dr. Robert Shulman, a psychiatrist and professor at Rush University Medical Center. Thank you for joining me tonight, Doctor.
It's my pleasure.
Now, suicide is on the rise. Can you give our listeners just some stats on suicide and what it means that we have this rise in suicide?
So the Center for Disease Control just came out with their, they do a weekly report, and the most recent one headlined the trends in suicide across the United States. And what they stated is that over the last 15 years, actually 17 years, there's been a marked increase in the rates of suicide across the board in every state. Actually, all except Nevada.
Nevada
is the only state that went down.
Everyone's still happy there.
And these are rates that are up to above 30%, which is
a lot.
It is a lot. And I think in 2015, they estimated, or they found that there were about 45,000 completed suicides, which is a which is now the 10th leading cause of death in the United States.
And that doesn't even include attempted suicides, because you have to look at that, I would imagine, to know how serious, you know, I mean, people don't always succeed in their attempts.
That is true. And the actual statistics, they can estimate. So they have statistics where they have about 11.4 self-harmful events that brought people to emergency departments for every completed suicide. However, obviously not every attempt, you know, ends up in the emergency room,
right,
the emergency department. And so putting together their data collection, they estimate about there are about 25 attempts, actually 28.3 attempts for every completed suicide.
So, again, this is a big question, but just generally speaking, what do the experts say, what do you believe in your practice, seeing these people come to you, what is causing this increased rate of suicide?
Well, I think it's multifactorial on multiple levels. I think that we certainly know that untreated mental illness or inadequately treated mental illness is a risk factor. I think that with the stressful environments occurring in the United States, as well as elsewhere, you know, it's hard to get by. There are a lot of stress. Stress causes bodily reactions, inflammation and stuff, and this can affect the working of the brain and is a risk factor for other, you know, mental illness and such. So I think that this contributes to it. I have my own personal beliefs.
Yeah, and I'd like to hear that, because you're close to it. You counsel people.
One of the things that we hear, or that we hear people describe that they go through in these cases, is this genuine sense of isolation. And, you know, for any number of reasons, when you look at the CDC report, they talk about loss of relationships, loss of job, impending crisis, impending financial crisis as all being risk factors. But on a personal level, what I see in my work, what we see in patients is this sense of isolation, where they may be surrounded by people, even surrounded by family and those that love them, yet they feel alone. They feel isolated. And my great concern is the rates going up with adolescents and young adults. We have seen, in terms of rates in the last 5 years, a bump up, actually in the last 7 years, a bump up in adolescent and young adult suicide at a greater incline than the other demographic groups. And I wonder how much of that is due to the fact that people today don't communicate face-to-face, eye-to-eye. They're communicating through a device. You walk into a restaurant, you see a group of young folks sitting there, and they're not really talking to each other, or all looking down at their phones. And I don't know if they're texting to each other through their phones, who knows, but there's not a lot of the face-to-face, not a lot of the human connectedness going on. And I wonder if that isn't a risk factor for this as well. I don't have the statistics, but I think people are actually looking at these phenomena.
And the statistics for adolescents, the one that I looked at said, I think it was that college-age students and even younger, that's the number two cause of death. Accidents first and then suicide second.
Yes.
I mean, that's an astounding statistic.
It is, and it's scary. And we see clusters, and something about adolescents and young adults having less resilience, less experience to fall back upon, and perhaps less resilience to these things. And so sometimes we'll see clusters. One of the questions that have come up with the recent two celebrity suicides is, will this lead to others.
The copycat effect.
Exactly. And we do see that. Just statistically, we will see clusters occurring after Robin Williams died.
Mm-hmm.
There was a brief uptick in suicides. I think that in small communities, high school communities and such, that when there is a suicide of one of the students, that there is also a couple more following that just around the few weeks following. So there is this cluster effect that we see with suicide. So there is some connection, some notion that if that other can do it, you know, why not me? I don't feel well, and boy, look at, you know, look, it can be done.
Well, if someone has suicidal tendencies, I would imagine that person looks at the person who committed suicide and says, wow, he doesn't have anything to worry about anymore. Maybe I should try. Who knows? I mean, it's hard to say that.
And there are a lot of different thought processes that goes through these things. And again, one of the deep down emotions that often accompany suicide, and it is the emotion that is probably the most intolerable for us. And the emotion is one of shame. And if there is a shame that one has for whatever reason, or if one is being bullied, you know, that kind of thing, if one doesn't feel successful, does not feel of significance, these are risk factors for suicide. So if you see others doing it and you're so caught up in yourself and you don't have necessarily a support network, you don't feel as though you can reach out to others, this is where the highest risk is.
We're talking to Dr. Robert Shulman of Rush University. I hear this, and I heard several celebrities like Val Kilmer, not that I trust what he's going to say, but I hear people say this. That was a selfish act. That was the most selfish thing a person could do. Is committing suicide selfish? I mean, I know that's a loaded question, but it just seems to me that I just never think of people being selfish when they commit suicide, because I think the pain must be so bad that you don't even want to live, and everyone wants to live, in my view.
I think that for most suicides, the pain is so great that one is unable to think about the consequences and how it affects others. The depressed person who, you know, sees no good coming from anything has, you know, almost delusional guilt in some of these cases, where they feel that they are responsible for the deaths of thousands or millions of children. I mean, I've seen this in my practice, people expressing these thoughts, that, you know, it's hard to say that, well, boy, they were just being selfish. That is really an unfair statement, I think, to people who are, for the most part, suffering tremendous change in the way they think. So if you think about depression especially as being a state that affects the way one thinks of oneself, the way one sees oneself in the world, the way it affects thoughts, feelings, perceptions, almost everything. And if you think a certain thought during the course of a depressed state, it may not be what you would think in the same circumstance when one is not depressed. So it's state-dependent thinking. And a lot of times it's just getting to the person at the right time and seeing them through it, because states change. Depression gets better. People will think differently. The big risk is, of course, if you add alcohol or some other disinhibiting chemical to a situation, I think gives the person a more opportunity, more chance to act out upon those thoughts.
Sure. Let's take a break. If you have any comments or questions for Dr. Shulman, please call me, 312-981-7200. And remember, at 8:30, we're going to be taking all your legal calls on any topic, 981-7200. We're here with Dr. Shulman, a psychiatrist and professor at Rush University Medical Center, and we're talking about suicide, and we're talking about it in light of the two very high-profile suicides that we saw this week. 981-7200, we have a caller who wants to talk. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'll get right to the point. I am a survivor of a suicide attempt. I do suffer from chronic depression. The intense anxiety that accompanied the depression when I was at my worst, unbelievable severe depression, led me to the point where I took about 100 milligrams of Xanax, and for by a miracle, I survived. The thing is, I can give one advice. If I could save one person out there right now, if they're contemplating an act of suicide, just pick up the phone and call somebody immediately, whether it's your doctor or whether it's a hotline or whatever, because you definitely need help. And, of course, now I'm on Effexor. The depression is, probably, 95% kind of quelled. Anxiety, I live day to day. It's nothing like it was.
John, thank you for your call, and it's a very heroic thing to say, and I hope that it helps at least one person, if not more. I'm going to put you on hold. Doctor, is that a common thing that someone reaches the end and then gets good medication and is doing okay?
Actually, yes. I think John's point is very important. I appreciate him bringing it up, that in that moment, if you just reach out, chances are you can get by past that moment. You can get through it. It will dispel. And John actually identified the second leading emotion that's the most intolerable amongst the other. We've talked about shame and anxiety. The kind of intense anxiety that John described is, in fact, a risk factor for suicide. And we know this based on biological studies that we did here at Rush 30 years ago, looking at certain urinary chemicals, metabolites and such, and the stress metabolite, the marker for stress and anxiety was the only biological marker that we found leading towards anything, and it was a risk factor for suicide. So I think John's report was very important, and I would also like to compliment John because, you know, with the stigma attached to these disorders, being able to speak about oneself,
yes, exactly,
is very important.
I felt the same thing. Let's give out the number for my Eric Hoffman, a friend of mine who's a funeral director, is urging us to give out the number for the suicide hotline.
Yes.
And what is that number, doctor?
The number is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. One can also text TALK, T-A-L-K, to 741-741. And I would like to offer another resource for individuals just and families as well, and educators and everyone else, and that's the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. It's afsp.org, which is a wonderful resource to learn about suicides and learn about resources for families and such. One of the things that gets missed, I think, in a lot of our discussions about suicide, besides risk factors and how to help people, is how can we help those whose loved ones have suicided?
Well, and that is something that I definitely want to discuss. And I want to tell you a brief story that has nothing to do with anyone close to me, but it was a client who killed himself, and he was going through a divorce. He had the world, to himself. He had a beautiful wife and children. He had bipolar. And I was the last call he made before he killed himself. And to this day, even though I'm not saying he's a family member, I cannot imagine that kind of trauma. But I still feel like I could have done something. Could I have said something? Should I have said something? Did I miss a sign? And there's a guilt attendant to that. I can't imagine how that's magnified if it's a loved one. And I do want to talk about what this does to people who are left behind.
No, I agree with you. And, I think all of us who are willing to treat people with mental illness go through this as well when we lose a patient, that we have all sorts of mental gymnastics that we go through. What if? Could I? Would it have changed? Well, what if I had done this and then something bad would have happened? How would I feel? So we have all those thoughts, and I think family has it even much more magnified, that there is guilt and there's anger and there's sadness. What's really interesting is I have a quick story to tell you about this because it's telling, and it's all about how we talk to people as well and how we understand it, is that a classmate of mine, somebody I actually knew from a family Sunday school, preschool age, suicided, and In talking to her best friend later on, she told me the story, and I think the family would be okay with me telling the story if they recognize it, because I think they have been proactive in discussing mental illness and such and the ravages that it can have, is that she was talking to this person's son or daughter, child, I'm not sure which, I think it was a son, and asked the question, are you angry at your mother? And his response was, well, that was not my mother. The Dementors had gotten to her. And it was at a time when the Harry Potter movies were out. And it was, sure, it was a wonderful way of actually conceptualizing it, that that was not my mother. That somebody else, something had taken over, and she just wasn't the same. So I don't blame her. And I think that's actually a wonderful way of looking at it for children, discussing these things with children, discussing mental illness and what it does and how it changes people. And it's not anybody's fault. And the truth of the matter is that you, myself, others, oftentimes there's nothing that we can necessarily do at that time. We may not recognize it, and it does us no good to feel bad about it. What we need to do is to go out and bring awareness to it and make contribution, whether it's through the foundation, the Suicide Prevention Foundation, NAMI, the march, the walks, the 24-hour, or the midnight walks out of darkness, things like that, to bring awareness to this thing. It's very important. I think that is the healthy way.
To do something positive rather than to dwell on the past.
Yes.
Dr. Schulman, thank you so much for joining us on this really important topic. If people want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Well, the problem is I give out this information, I get calls. No, I'm just kidding. So Rush University, my practice is there. I'm vice chair in the department. If they call the Rush University number, and we have a clinic, we have access to care, and we have providers. So more than just me, I think, just reaching out. If you don't have a provider, if you have a primary care provider, they can provide resources. All the university hospitals in the city have clinics and access to care and such.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. The other side of the half an hour, we're going to be taking all your legal calls, 981-7200. Text to that same number, 981-7200. You're listening to WGN. We got a little bit of a late start for legal questions, but now's the time. We're going to get in as many as possible. I'll try to answer your legal questions. I've been a practicing lawyer for over 30 years, and I can try to guide you in the right direction or give you an answer. If for some reason you don't reach me here at the radio studio, or if you want to have a more private talk, you can call me at 312-332-7800. It's a private line. Or better yet, email me with your issue. Where do you live? What do you need? When did it happen? What are you looking for? That's WGN at AskKarenConti.com, and it's Karen, K-A-R-E-N, Conti, C-O-N-T-I. You might want to put that in your phone, might want to write it down, because you don't always need a lawyer, but when you do, you want to make sure you have contact information or a friend of yours or a family member, and I'm always happy to give a referral. If I don't know how to handle something, or I don't handle something, or I'm not in your area, I usually know somebody who is trusted, who I can refer you to, who at least can get you in the right direction. But I'm going to be taking your legal calls right now, and they're lining up, 981-7200. I just want to read a few texts. 847 area code. I've been living with bipolar for 20 years. My point is I was not able to tell anybody about it because of the shame. And this is what Dr. Schulman was saying, the horrible shame. My mom and my sister both took their own lives, and that's just a horrible thing. I hope you're doing much better. I got an interesting text. I'm not sure I agree with this person. If your quality of life is no longer good, says the 412 area code, what's wrong with killing yourself? I just don't get how you think. We put animals down all the time and no one bats an eye. Well, I don't think that's the right way to think about it. I think that if you are going to kill yourself, you probably have illness, and you probably have mental illness that can be helped and can be counseled or can be medicated, and that if you're in your right mind, you don't want to kill yourself. I don't know that even people who sustain horrible tragedies in their lives want to kill themselves unless they're in some sort of mental illness situation. I suppose if someone is terminally ill with cancer and they're in pain and they want to make an educated decision to do that, that, that's another story. But mental illness can be helped. It can be medicated. And I don't believe that we should allow people to put people down like they're animals. I don't think that's the right avenue. But thank you for the text, and I appreciate all of your calls. Let me give out the numbers again, and I'm going to go to the phones, 981-7200. You're listening to Karen Conti. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this morning when it was so wet, I went into a fast foods establishment, and the floor was wet from people coming in from the rain, and I fell,
ooh,
and I hurt my wrist real, it's in pain. And I went, looked at other stores. They have mats or runners or something you can step on. You don't have to walk on the slippery flooring as soon as you get in. Is this restaurant liable to provide something to prevent that?
Yeah, I mean, when you own a restaurant and you expect that people are going to be coming in and there's always going to be snow and rain in Chicago, there's a duty to make it safe for the patrons to come in. And once they were notified, once they had notice, meaning they saw the wet floor, they should have done something. So even if they didn't have mats, they should have put a warning sign. They should have put down something to you know, there were things that they could have done.
Newspapers would have even helped.
Anything. So the bottom line is, the question is, are they legally responsible for your injury? They probably are. The question is your injury enough for a lawyer to take your case? Because there's always the do you have a case question. And the second question is, will a lawyer take it? Because lawyers have to file a lawsuit, which is costly, and they have to spend their time. So the question is there enough damages? And so what I would suggest to you, Jenny, why don't you give me an email at my office or give me a call? I can hook you up with a lawyer who does this kind of work. The bottom line is, you know, you might want to go to the hospital. You might want to go to a doctor to get it checked out to make sure you don't have a break or something. And if you want to pursue this, you're going to have to document that you were injured, and you want to make sure you get all the treatment necessary so that you get better. So I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to give out the numbers again. My number is 312-332-7800, and it's WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Anthony. Hi, Anthony. Anthony, you have a legal question? Hello. Hi.
Yes, I do.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I was just telling the producer, have a son. My ex and I have a son. Went to court for a year and a half over custody and child support and all those, you know, parenting agreement, all that kind of stuff. Point half about back medical stuff, about retroactive daycare, future daycare, whether or not she could take my son out of the state without my permission.
Okay.
Finally, after a year and a half, we were about to go in front of a judge, and we did go in front of a judge. He asked us to step outside to try to talk it over one more time before he made a decision. We did that. We went outside. This was 3.5 years ago. We went outside his courtroom. We discussed it all. And they said, you know what? We're going to take out everything that you have a problem with. We're taking out this, this, and this. Went back in front of the judge, and he was the nicest guy in the world. He commended us for working it out together, for not making him make a decision. He said if more people could do that, the whole process would be a much better thing. And so then her attorney asked the judge if her client, my ex, could not have to miss work the next week when we finalized the whole thing. He turned to me and said, asked me if it was okay with me. I said, absolutely. I just spent a year and half of my life going there once a month.
Okay.
More,
okay. Let's
hammer it out.
Okay.
So he said, after I said it's fine with me, he said, you know what, since it's okay with you, he said, I'm gonna say that you don't have to be here as well, as long as you both communicate with his office.
Okay.
And we continue to work it out like we said we were. Everything will be fine. I got emails from her lawyer saying, yes, we took this out.
Okay, just wait. We're going to have to get to the question.
I apologize.
That's okay.
The next week when the court case was going on, I had talked with her lawyer. I agreed on the new everything. I agreed on everything through email. I contacted the judge as I was told to let him know that I agreed with everything, and that was, you know, that was fine with me. I wasn't going to be there per his instructions.
Okay, all right. Hold on. I got to stop you here because we got to get to the question. Did the agreement get entered?
No, the next week she found me in default with through the judge for not being there.
Okay, so I
didn't know any of this until she's now suing me 3.5 years later for thousands of dollars of stuff that we had stricken out of our agreements.
Okay, so here's a couple things, and I'm really sorry. I don't mean to be rude, but I have other callers, and I some of these facts I just want to get to it. Okay, so if you call in, I'm happy to talk to you, but you got to get to the question that you're going to ask me. Okay, this is something that should have been worked out. Your lawyer. If your lawyer told you you didn't have to be in court, the lawyer should have taken care of it. A default, that means that you didn't show up and the judge just decided that you lose everything or the other side wins everything because you weren't there. By virtue of you not showing up, the judge ruled against you. That shouldn't have been what happened. So the first order of business is to call your lawyer and say, how did that happen? You might even want to go to the court and get your court file to find out exactly what happened that day. Did your lawyer not show up? Did your lawyer not speak up for you? What was entered and what happened? So you can have your lawyer address this because that's what you have a lawyer for. You shouldn't have, and I don't know how you didn't know this was entered for 3.5 years. Now she's suing you for child support or whatever it is. You're going to have to really unravel this, and it's hard after a judgment is entered to go back and unravel something. So I guess I can't give you specific advice, Anthony, but I would say to all the listeners out there, talk to your lawyer, communicate with your lawyer, get copies of everything. If you're in litigation, you want copies of all the motions and all the orders and everything that happens in court so you have a file and you know what your rights are, you know what your obligations are, and you know how to follow them, because if there's a court order, you have the obligation to honor it. And if you don't, all kinds of bad things can happen. They can take you to court. They can take away your driver's license. They can issue a judgment against you. They can take away your house. So it's very important to know exactly what's happening with your attorney. Thank you for the call. I'm going to take a quick break, but I want your calls on any legal topic. If you have a family law issue, a criminal law issue, breach of contract, small claim, neighborhood disputes. I had one call me. I'm going to talk about that on the other side. Give us a call here at 312-981-7200. This is the Karen Conti Show. This is your last chance. We've got a few minutes left, but the phone lines are wide open. If you have a legal question on any topic, give me a call here. 312-981-7200. And if you don't get through, you can always call me at the office, 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com, KarenConti. I have a 224 area code texter who says, do I have any rights if I am raising a child that is not mine? The child calls me daddy, and I have a very good relationship with the mother. I don't believe she will ever take the child away from me, but what happens if something happens to the mother? Basically, you don't have any rights. If you're basically step-parenting a child, and you don't have any legal obligations or legal rights unless you adopt the child. And if you adopt the child, you would have to go through a court procedure where you would give the biological father notice of your intent to adopt the child, and he would have a right to come in and contest that. And frankly, it's a very difficult thing. If he's paying child support, if he's seeing the child, you probably would not be successful in the adoption. And you always have to really think about whether you want to adopt, because those rights are forever then. If you adopt successfully, you will then be obligated to pay child support. You might be obligated to pay college expenses and health insurance and expenses like that. So it's nice that you have a great relationship, but unfortunately, there's really no legal avenue to secure that relationship other than a good relationship with the child's mother. Let's see. Why do judges have all the power in the courtroom? Please recommend a book about their power. Why do judges have all the power in the courtroom? Well, I don't really understand that, because the judge is the one making decisions, right? If it's a jury trial, the jury is making decisions with the judge basically presiding over the jury. But
there's got to be someone making decisions in the courtroom, and they do have all the power. Now, you could also argue that your attorney has power. It could be your attorney is your advocate, and your attorney is hopefully a skilled legal practitioner who knows the law and is good on their feet and is prepared and who can influence the judge, and hopefully the judge is an open-minded person who is going to listen to the arguments and do the right thing according to the law. So I don't know that I have a book that explains any of that. I think it's kind of fundamental, but thank you for the text. Let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You have a legal question.
I don't know if it's legal or what, but here's my question, is that I have an aluminum-sided townhouse in a subdivision with about 100 of them. Probably in the last 2 years, at least a quarter of them have had their houses resided because of wind or hail damage. And recently, my house had some panels come off, and I called the adjuster, and they came out and took a look at it, and they denied it, not only the panels, because they said that was due to just wear and tear, but also, even though the house directly butting up against mine next door, had her paneling determined that it was hail damage and got new siding for the whole house, there was a decision that there was not hail damage on my house. And I don't understand the logic.
Yes.
That one house can have it and the other doesn't, and have, you know, a bunch of the houses in the subdivision. So is that a legal question? Or
well, yes. And so, okay. So, Pat, what we're talking about, I'm going to put you on hold. What we're talking about is insurance coverage. You make a contract with your insurance carrier, whatever that insurance carrier is. You give them your premium, and in exchange, they cover certain things. And they also don't cover certain things. And no one really reads their policy because they don't need to read it until something happens. But a lot of things are excluded. And normal wear and tear is not something that is covered by a homeowner's policy, but damage due to weather is generally covered by insurance. The question is, each insurance carrier has a different view on what the damage is. And if you have a very good insurance carrier, I'm not saying yours is a bad one, I'm just saying good insurance carriers do the right thing and they pay a claim. Bad insurance carriers, whether this is for auto, whether this is for health, whether this is for house, they will deny your coverage because they don't want to pay it, and they think they can get away with it, and that's what happens. And unfortunately, we have a lot of substandard and carriers who might be denying claims that they should be paying. So the way to handle this, there is probably an appeals process that you go through. You're going to want to get a written denial, ask them for a written denial if they haven't already done it, and you want to know the provision, you want to know the reasons, and you want to see the documentation as to why they're denying your coverage, and then you should write a letter back saying, but these homes all were deemed to be damaged by weather and their insurance carriers are covering it. We think this is an inappropriate denial of coverage, and we want to take it to the next step. There's probably an appeals procedure with your insurance carrier that will require you to get some repair estimates and some proof of your claim and send it in, and maybe you want to do that at the beginning just so they have it all in front of them, and you can fight it that way. Hiring a lawyer to sue an insurance carrier on this kind of thing, probably not cost effective, but that's my best advice to you. Bob, what is your legal question? Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Yes, I have a person that's walking through my yard and leaving the gates open. So I was wondering what legal rights do I have against unauthorized people?
So people, is it one person or just a bunch of people?
Well, I don't know. I haven't caught them yet, but but if I catch them, do I have the right to retain them and call the police?
No, you don't want to do that. I think that you should, if you see somebody, I mean, you know, listen, we're in a world full of anxiety and people who are carrying guns and doing all kinds of strange things. I wouldn't confront people, you know, in a way that is accusatory unless you're really willing to have the ramifications. I would
if you see somebody in your yard and that person is cutting through your yard and leaving gates open and is trespassing on your property, I think you should go out there. You might just say to him, do you mind not coming on my property? You're trespassing. Next time I see you do this, I'm going to have to call the police. Hopefully that'll be enough, okay? But, you know, you might want to take a picture of the person, and you might want to ask them why he's trespassing. But try to handle it in a friendly manner before you go and you try to confront someone physically, because you just don't know what people are about. And someone who's, I'm sorry, dumb enough to trespass on someone's personal property are, you know, doing a risky thing these days. So he may not be in his right mind, so you don't want to add fuel to that fire. But thank you for the call. It's a very bad thing to have neighbor disputes. And in fact, I just want to end with one story. It's really fast. A lovely listener called me and said she had a neighborhood dispute in another state. She said there was a boundary dispute. The house was being sold, and all of a sudden there were boundary disputes, and it was stopping the sale of the house. And I said, listen, get a licensed surveyor to come out and draw the lines and find out if there's an encroachment. That's what we call it. And also call your title insurance carrier, because when you have a mortgage, you probably have title insurance, and they were supposed to have done this and maybe disclosed to you that there was an encroachment. So you do those things first before you hire a lawyer, and hopefully you can resolve it, because, again, getting involved in litigation, people want to run and call a lawyer, but it's real expensive, and it's real iffy, and it takes a long time and a lot of energy, and you want, you probably have better things to do and better ways to resolve your problems. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to all my guests tonight. Thank you, Cash, my producer, and Jerry, my husband, who's my gatekeeper here for guests. And have a wonderful Father's Day.